Well, greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for this, the Limemark Technical Net. So it's been going strong for many, many years, and hopefully many more to go. Let's see. Every Sunday night, we get together and chat on the radio. Hopefully teaching each other stuff and learning from each other and entertaining each other. So I thank you all for coming back once again for another episode of this, the Limemark Technical Net. Let me drop for a second and I will give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, I have two email addresses you could use. That would be either for questions for the technical net, or if you want to present a topic or be part of a topic, or if you have a TechNet puzzle. I do have a TechNet puzzle tonight. If we have time for it, I will let it loose. It's a relatively short one, but I hope it'll be entertaining. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to discuss something that you saw on a NASA-related or a space-related YouTube or article on the web. So my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. You could also use roy@limarktech.net. Of course, you can go direct to Paul. He has an email address. It's spacenetreport@gmail.com. We have a link page of interesting articles that I've collected over the last week and YouTubes and such. You can get to it by typing into your browser either roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net. We have a chat room available that's been very, 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 very quiet. You can get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net. We also have an audio stream that I provide on the Internet so people without radios can listen in to the technical net and listen in to the Glen Oaks repeater the rest of the week. It's available 24/7. You can get there by typing in technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And, of course, I'd like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limemark Technical Net that go as far back as September 2006. So avail yourself of it, if at all possible. A lot of wisdom from hams that have moved away from the area or become silent keys. Let me drop, and I'll tell you what I got planned.
KD2OGB Mobile. Real quick, Roy?
Yes, Greg?
Yeah, I don't know if NY2H is listening, but I can't hear you on Selden right now. I can hear you on Glen Oaks and Middle Island, but I can't hear you on KPQ right now, so I'm on VL right now.
Okay, that's part of my problem as well. I had set up my browser to be able to remote, but it lost the page, and it's going to take me a little time to find it in my email, unfortunately. So I wish I could do magic for you, but hopefully if Lou is around, I need you, our guardian angel, to kind of reboot the All-Star link. It seems to have screwed up once again. You know, if I had free time to kind of rummage through my email, I would find it and reboot it myself, but it's kind of difficult to do the technical net and rummage through in the email. So hopefully Lou is listening.
And 3J for the moment.
T-Mobile, Selden is fine.
Oh, okay. Then I'm totally confused. I don't understand Craig's problem then.
It just suddenly clicked on, so I'm probably just not within range of it. And plus, because my antenna's facing the west right now, since I'm going east, that's probably why I'm able to pick up VL right now. Never mind. Selden's working.
Okay. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
I'm not sure if it's my radio, but I hear echo. The first time you tried your radio today, there was no echo. At least I don't recall it. It was short, and now I have a big echo. Is it only me, or is it you, Dr. Roy?
There's no reason for an echo here. Does anyone else hear an echo?
I don't hear an echo at all. I think I'm not close enough to Selden. Thanks for flashing your eyes at me, idiot. That's probably why I'm not here in Selden right now. And no, I do not hear an echo right now.
No echo.
Okay, let me see if I have it. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry, Wes, for your echo, but I don't think it's that. The first one was through All-Star. I'm able to get right through All-Star, but unfortunately, for some odd reason, I can't hear anything through All-Star. So if I hooked up things so that I would listen through the radio but talk through the mic, I would end up getting a reverb of some kind. So we're just going to try it with good old-fashioned RF tonight. So anyway, the plans for tonight are that we will take questions of a technical nature, hopefully beginning with amateur radio-related type questions, but we will open it up to all science and technology, as we always do. And that should take us to about 10:15. If I have an opportunity, I have a small TechNet puzzle available that I would love to share with the rest of you. So hopefully we'll get to that tonight. So 10:15, Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report, and that should take us to 11 p.m., and I will return to put a bow on things and wish you well for the following week. So that's the plan if propagation, radios, computers, and what have you keep working the way they're supposed to and don't screw things up. That's the idea. Also, before we begin tonight, I just want to take a jibe because what the hell, at good old Elon Musk. He gets enough good public relations through the SpaceNet report. I just discovered a very curious and, to me, funny thing about the Cybertruck. The Cybertruck, as some of you might know, is this bullet-proof glass electronic vehicle that stones go right through the windows. So it's really kind of non-bulletproof, bulletproof glass. I discovered something. Let me drop for a second because I don't want to time out here. Okay. I found out something amazing about Tesla's stainless steel covering of the Cybertruck. It's not the generic stainless steel. It's a proprietary alloy of Tesla's own design, which amazingly is not stainless. It corrodes, and it doesn't have a protective layer on the underside or the surface. So, you know, if you put a wet beer can on your Tesla Cybertruck and leave it for the night, you'll get a stain ring for the rest of your existence, unless you want to burnish it out. So yet another great thing about the Cybertruck I just wanted to share with you. Anyway, with that aside, let's go with the technical questions and topics and such. So anyone who has any of those, you know the way we work this. Hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
KE2-82-OGB Mobile, nothing at the moment. And my AF is kind of low on Selden, so still not able to hear you.
Okay, kind of interesting that you're responding to me, but you can't hear me, but I understand. It's not a great signal. Anyone else want to put their name down who hopefully has a question or a comment for tonight?
KE2ALP amateur related question.
Okay. Anyone else?
W2BZ. Not amateur, but technical.
Okay, anyone else?
KD2VHD with both amateur and a electric car topic for later at this time. Not necessary, but at this time.
Okay, Jim so noted. So anyone else before we get down to business?
Sent you an email, and if you get a chance, just have a look at it. It's pertinent to the net, so it's not gratuitous.
Oh, I understood that he was under the weather. Someone told me that he was in the hospital a week ago.
So feel free to do with that what you may.
Okay, I think it's appropriate. You know, he was a very important guy. We'll get to the questions in a moment. Jeff just sent me email that a guy who was if you ever got an issue of QST every other month, they had the volunteer examiner's honor roll, and on the very tippity top of it in the region two was Paul Maytan, AC2T. I believe he was about 89. He signed my VE exam. I took my exam back in 2011 over at the police department. Was one of the many places that he gave VE exams. So he signed my certificate. He signed probably thousands of certificates. So we want to inform people that Paul Maytan, AC2T, recently passed away. May he rest in peace.
JC2, call that, Charlie.
Yes.
I do have a technical question.
Oh, okay. We'll put you on the list. Can you give me your call sign one more time? Okay, very good. So, may he rest in peace. Another silent key, another giant that has passed beyond the veil. There are too many of them going in that direction. I'd love to figure out a way around that that reality of life. But nevertheless, back to regular business. KE2ALB, you have a question?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ivan, Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Lima Papa. I have a quick question. I read on my news feed, so apparently Japanese installed their first amateur radio station on the moon that is transmitting CW. I was monitoring it. I was with my beam, 70 centimeter Yagi. Apparently the frequency is 437.410 megahertz. Anyway, I was unsuccessful. Just curious if anyone knows about it and we're lucky to get the CW signal from the moon.
Okay, Ivan, that's a good question. I've heard people kind of discussing it in the background lately. I would imagine that you would need a much more significant reception capability. There is an old postcard of Dick K2RW, may he rest in peace, who had an array of Yagis that would have seemed insane, but he needed it for his moon bounce operations. And, you know, old-time moon bouncers who don't use the Joe Taylor algorithms needed a lot of power, so they were the guys who built linear amplifiers for UHF operation, and they also needed a lot of gain on their Yagis, and so they had these massive arrays of Yagis pointed at the moon. So I would be sort of surprised if a guy with a single Yagi or even a pair of Yagis is going to be able to pick up that signal. I don't know offhand what the signal strength of the transmitter is, which will make a big effect. But anyone out there know anything more or have tried to pick up the CW signal?
Be less to answer.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, that was on a slim lander, and they had these two little balls that came out of the side of it, you know, and they opened up, and one of them takes pictures of the lander, and apparently the other one had the capability of not only transmitting back to the lander, but it was transmitting 1 watt. That's it. And they actually gave it a call sign, JS1YMG, Julia Sierra 1 Yankee Mike Gulf. And, officially that would be the first transmission of a ham signal from from the moon, and yeah, 70 centimeters, like the other fellow said. And they call it LEV-1 and LEV-2 is the little balls that came out of it. Apparently one of the two, I forget which one, has this 1-watt transmitter on it. But right now you're not going to hear it because, you know, it's now in darkness. You're going to have to wait another probably about 15, 16 days at least before any kind of light gets back onto that setup that they got up there. But even at that point, everything should probably be quite dead going through a lunar, which is 14 days. Had a couple of days of transmitting, but I think that's pretty much come to an end. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you for that. Do you know offhand if people have been picking up the signal, you know, regular amateur radio operators, and if so, what type of receiver setup, how many antennas did it take for them to pick up the signal?
I read in three different locations, three different websites, and not one of them said that anybody was receiving anything. I don't know if anybody copied anything. It is transmitting CW.
Oh, okay, so that'll be interesting to see what becomes of it. You know, no one kind of, I don't know the power output. It might be minuscule. So, and most of the old-time moon bouncers, I think, have retired from the field. You know, once Joe Taylor kind of spoiled it for them by doing it through a computer algorithm that allows a very low signal to be received, a lot of them just kind of got annoyed at the new generation of moon bouncers and didn't maintain their equipment. So he'll be curious to see as time goes on. I'll be looking for that in websites and see if there's any information about that, because I would be incredibly curious about what the receiver requirements would be required for something like that. How much gain would you need on an array of directional antennas to pick it up? So we'll find out hopefully as time goes on. Thank you, Paul.
1 watt. I thought I said that before. 1 watt. That's all that thing is transmitting. 1 watt.
Okay, well, lots of luck to anyone trying to listen to that. I mean, early moon bounce was problematic as well. They reflected, a lot of times they reflected a full legal power to the moon, but by the time it got there and dispersed and reflected back, it was probably far, far weaker than a 1 watt transmitter on the surface. So we'll see. Anyone else with any comments or has read or heard about any other aspect of this?
Additional?
Yes.
This is WI2M, Whiskey India 2, Mike. Just following along that story and listening to the net just to confirm what Paul was saying. That they do not anticipate it surviving the lunar night, which is correct. I think it's 14 hours. They weren't expecting it to survive and take a recharge, but you never know, as satellites have proven otherwise in the past. Just wanted to add that in there. WI2M listening.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So, you know, we may never hear from it, unfortunately, but at the very least, it will be a historical footnote. That'll be written up in some books on the subject for future generations. So thank you. And Ivan, I don't know. I wouldn't be terribly optimistic that you're going to be hearing a CW signal from the moon anytime too soon.
Roger, roger. Well, I was curious. I wasn't lucky myself so far. And was curious if anybody else had any other experiences. You know, I see the moon sometimes right outside of my window. My antenna faces it. I'll just keep the frequency on, and and maybe something will come out of it in 14, 15 days once the lunar night is over. Anyway, thank you for sharing your insights. Back to that, AE2AOB.
And one more thing, Roy, WS1.
Yeah, sure.
I did have it in my notes. LEV1, these two balls that came out of it, out of the lander. They have the transmitter, and the other one has a camera in it. And if you see pictures of the SLIM on the moon, it's taken from one of the LEVs. I think it's a landing excursion model or vehicle or something like that. Anyway, the LEV-1 is the one with it. And I believe it has the same frequency that he just gave, that Ivan just gave, 437.41 megahertz. So, and if you see the pictures, the whole craft is kind of like upside down, and the solar panel is like facing the wrong direction. They wanted it to face one particular direction to face the sun, and it was facing the wrong direction. So the batteries went dead almost dead real quick. They brought everything down to a low power. And then, sure enough, as the sun changed the angle on the surface of the moon, the panel was able to pick up some power, and they were able to resume normal operations for a while, including this 1 watt transmitter. But now it's in darkness. Now you got 14 days of darkness, and then you have to wait a few more days after that, because again, the solar panel is facing the wrong direction. So you'll have to wait, maybe another, instead of 14 days, maybe 18 days to see if the sun hits that array and the little LEV1. Hopefully it works. Maybe it'll start transmitting again. You don't know. They're gonna wait and see. Back to you, Brian.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, stranger things have happened, and it doesn't cost you anything to hope and listen, and we'll see what the future brings. Hopefully it will kind of start up after the sun shines on the batteries for a while, and we'll hear some more of it. But so apparently we're not going to hear anything for the next 2 weeks until we give it a chance for the solar batteries to see some sunlight. Okay, we'll see what happens. We'll keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best. Okay, so let's move on to our next person. Since we don't have really that many people, I'll just do it in the order that people checked in. So, Rich, W2BZ, what's your question for tonight or your topic?
I'm sorry about it. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody else. I'm on Echo Link now, but I'm going to switch to my radio. So just give me a second there. Okay. There we go. I've asked this question before, but I still don't understand the technology and how it works. My car battery was working fine until a few days ago, where all of a sudden it wouldn't start the car. And I have a little booster pack, which when I put it on, the terminals, the car started. So it is the battery. I'm confused, or I don't know. How does a battery, in this case, of course, a lead acid car battery, work, then boom, fall off a cliff and it doesn't work? What's happening within the battery for it to just fall off a cliff like that and stop working, as opposed to, it being harder and harder and harder to start the car? It was starting fine, and then all of a sudden it wasn't. So what's happening within the battery? How does that work, Roy?
AC2GS. Okay. Well, I think generally speaking, you need a significant amount of current to start the engine and have the generator run, and that supplies the power to recharge the battery. So you might have enough power in the battery to keep the lights going, but not quite enough current to be able to turn over the engine itself. So you can have a case where it doesn't kind of just slowly get worse and worse. It just works one day as far as turning over the engine and doesn't work the next day. Lead acid cell batteries deteriorate primarily these days. It was different in the old days that they weren't sealed. You would have to remember to keep topping off the water in it, because lead acid cell batteries are basically a lead oxide electrode, a lead electrode in a bath of sulfuric acid. And so the sulfuric acid solution would evaporate and you'd have to refill it. There were hygrometers that a lot of people probably still remember. But nowadays with gels and sealed valves and such, there's no real way to check on your fluid level. You just hope and assume that it's staying where it's supposed to. Let me drop for a sec.
820 GB Mobile for comment.
Yeah, one second, Craig. I just want to finish my thought, and then you can have your say. The primary failure mode, I believe, for lead-acid batteries these days is something called sulfonation. It's where sulfur starts to coat the electrode, when it does that, it decreases the surface area where the chemical reaction producing the current is provided. So little by little, your electrodes get coated by sulfur. There are devices designed to kind of pulse charge batteries that promises to help to desulfonate the electrodes. Some of them work, some of them don't work, but that's my understanding of what's going on with lead acid batteries. You wanted to say something, Craig?
The electrodes can deteriorate over time, and eventually it makes the battery weaker and weaker to the point where it loses its charge very slowly and you won't be able to start the car. Keep in mind, your battery is mainly used to start, but where you're really getting all your energy from just to keep the car running, provided from the battery, is the alternator, since that's keeping the car running. Because if you lose your alternator, then you're specifically running off the battery, which only would be for a short while, and then once your battery dies because of the alternator, then everything goes, since your alternator pretty much powers everything. And nowadays, batteries are sealed, so all those things we had to do in the past, you don't usually do anymore. Not only that, you also want to measure cold cranking amps, your amperage, and also your temperature of the battery, because as the battery ages, the cold cranking amps get less and less, and eventually you get harder starts, and eventually the battery will just give up, and then you would need to jump it. And when you jump it, that's the signifying right there that you should get it tested and or replaced, because while it may start the car, eventually it no longer meets the minimum expectations and is likely to fail soon. Here's another common thing that people actually do when it comes to batteries and alternators. Just give me a sec. One thing you absolutely never do under any circumstances is remove either side of the battery while the car is running. People do that to make sure that the alternator is still good, but you can't do that in a modern car. You do that, you can cause voltage spikes that will ruin all the computers, and it's not like you have one modulator in there. The average car has like 70 to 80 different computers. Some of the newer ones that are electric, they have like a number of ones. You never do that under any circumstances.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Now you're in my wheelhouse. Craig, a very good point about not disconnecting the battery. That used to be a very valid way to check the system. You will do damage if you do that. So with that, you're correct. On the other things, it sounds like this car's battery died today, in which case the car battery most likely didn't die. If it had died on one of the cold days we had, I would suspect the battery first. But because it died today, it sounds like, I'm waiting for feedback on that, you probably have a loose or corroded terminal that needs to be cleaned and tightened. Because when you put the boost pack on, you're bypassing that connection at the battery, and you're actually connected to the electrical system side of that connection, and it'll start the car. And the battery will get enough current through a full connection to run the car without starting. So if it failed on one of the last cold days we had, I'd suspect battery. If it failed today, I'd suspect the terminals.
Your best bet is to get your battery and your charging system tested as well. Don't just test the battery, you want to test both, because sometimes your alternator might not be providing enough current, or it could be providing too much current. Some people have even seen, when they do disconnect the battery while the car is running, the lights get brighter. Again, you never do that because you can damage the computers if you do that. Now, generally, if your headlights get brighter upon disconnecting the battery while the car is running, then that can be one of two things. Either you do have a crappy battery, or your alternator is putting out so much current that when you remove the cable and take the battery out of the whole equation, the lights will get brighter. That's when you want to have your alternator load tested. You could have an alternator putting out too much voltage. That's another thing. It's called alternators are alternators for a reason, because they create alternating current, and they have diodes that turn it into direct current. And if those diodes break, you can get an alternator feeding like 80 to 90 volts into the battery, causing it to overcharge and destroy it. Another thing, when you mention corroded terminals, is that creates heat. Alternators are going to have to keep recharging the battery at a higher rate, get hot, and eventually that'll lead to your battery overcharging, and that can damage it as well.
PHK with a follow-up?
Sure, Jim.
This can easily go into Tesla territory, but it's not that complicated. Clean and tighten the terminals, make sure they're mechanically sound, and try again. That's step one. The rest of the stuff is step six.
Okay, very good, Jim. And of course, since it's another opportunity to say something nasty about good old Elon, recently during the cold snap, apparently there were a lot of Teslas that could not be fast charged in Chicago and were kind of left to their own until the weather warmed up, because batteries and as well as lithium-ion technology batteries do much better in warm weather than they do in bitterly cold weather. And, you know, the time it takes to quick charge a lithium-ion battery in sub-sub-zero temperatures is much longer than it is when it's nice and summery out there. Okay, I couldn't quite make out what you said, but it sounded like I doubled, so I'll try one more time. I just want to point out that during the recent cold snap in Chicago, there were a bunch of Teslas that were stuck because they couldn't fast charge themselves because of the inclement weather.
Roy, let me see if I have it. This is W2BC.
More information?
Yeah, Jim and Rich doubled. Rich first?
Yeah, to answer Jim's question, it decided not to start last week in 20-degree weather. Whenever we had a 20-degree day, that's when it didn't work, Jim.
Jim, go ahead.
That would lead me to suspect the battery more than the terminals. Batteries fail at that cold point, you know, as they deteriorate. That's where you notice it. So that's likely the battery. And your question about the sulfation, the desulfating charging, it does not get rid of the sulfating. There are chargers. I use one that has a desulfating feature. It's a trickle charger that has a desulfating feature. Apparently, it kind of puts a square wave on the DC charging current. I've anecdotally noticed that it seems to have some effect, but most probably, if your car battery fails when it's 20 degrees, it's probably the battery, and the cold temperature took it to its weakest point, and it failed. So since our cars need to be reliable, you probably need to just replace the battery. If you want to take the battery out of the car to be tested, they can verify that for you. Like AutoZone, I think, does that for free. So that's an easy one. But most probably you need a battery. Based on the fact that it failed at cold.
KD2OGB Mobile. Batteries work harder during the cold weather, and so do the alternators. Usually, that tends to make your battery, it makes it harder to start the car. And when your car is running, your battery is running between 14 to 15 volts by the alternator because of how cold it is, and usually during the summertime, it's less than that, usually 14 or 13 volts, maybe down to 12. But during cold weather, both work harder to keep them going. By the way, I'm parked, so I'm going to send it back to Roy. KD2OGB Mobile to Net Control and QRT.
Okay, very good. Let me just make sure I have the repeater because we're all doubling tonight. Okay, I seem to have it. I'd rather than anthropomorphize batteries that they work harder. Batteries are just chemical reactions. They're oxidation reduction reactions where electrons get exchanged. And instead of it happening in solution, it's taken out of solution and done through a cathode and an anode and wire between the two. And so as you lower the temperature with pretty much all batteries, because they're all chemical reactions, the kinetic energy decreases and its ability to produce charge gets more problematic. What happens is the output charge gets lower and lower as you lower the temperature, and you get to a certain point where the charge output is not enough to turn over the engine, and then you have a big problem. So it's a function of just chemistry. Chemistry works better and faster at higher temperatures. That's why a lot of chemists are shown boiling stuff, because a lot of chemical reactions take off when you boil them or when you heat them to a higher degree than ambient temperature. So I just wanted to kind of add that little chemistry concept.
Now, what happens when you charge a battery? What happens inside the battery?
I think I heard Jim. We'll give it to you in a second. Basically, you're reversing the chemical reaction. You're forcing the electrons in the opposite direction. And so the electron exchange that ran the battery, in the case of rechargeable batteries, runs in reverse, and you remanifest the electrodes other than the sulfonation, which gets in the way. But otherwise, as the cathode and anode discharge the electrical stored power, It destroys aspects of the electrode that have to be rebuilt by reversing the current with an external electric recharging circuit. Jim, you wanted to say something?
It's K2CJE. Don't just pull that battery. There are some cars that have to maintain the voltage so the computer doesn't get unhappy and they make a gizmo to plug it to the cigarette lighter off.
Yeah, there are a lot of new problems with our modern cars today. In the old days, you could do anything you wanted with a battery because there was very little attached to it, maybe a car radio. Nowadays, as Craig mentioned, there's a lot of processing devices and a lot of equipment, and I know of a gentleman who took out his battery, reset the circuits in his in his car so that he had to drive all over New York before it would pass an inspection, because the way that these processes often work is they have feedback mechanisms. They're self-adjusting. But if you pull the battery and there's no little dime battery holding the memory, it blanks it and resets it to factory reset. So whenever you play around with batteries, keep in mind that you don't have a car anymore. You have a computer with wheels.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Good thoughts. Most cars, it's not a fatal problem, but it definitely, once you disconnect the battery on almost all cars, you've lost the OBD2 check mark that lets them pass inspection. It also resets a lot of the learning features. Cars learn how you drive these days. Like, if I let my wife drive my truck and I get it in it afterwards, it don't drive the same because it learns the way she mashes the pedal like a lunatic. And I don't do that, and the car just doesn't react the same way. They most cars these days learn, and I don't like that. But it is a fact. And putting a battery into the cigarette lighter to maintain that voltage is a good idea. It's a good idea. It's not necessarily necessary, but it can simplify your life tremendously. I concur to that.
Okay, I wonder how long it's going to take for automobile manufacturers to build in profiles for different drivers of the same car. I mean, they do it for a lot of other pieces of equipment. It probably wouldn't be that much of a pain in the backside to implement.
I believe some of them do.
Okay, that makes sense.
Car drive differently after your wife drives it?
My particular truck has a very interesting 10-speed automatic transmission that does magic. Ford uses it, and it's an odd collaboration between and GM that they developed this transmission. And while it has a hiccup, I think it works terrific. And so while she drives like a race car and I drive like a tugboat, the way that the shifts happen when you put your foot on the pedal, it's just like when I drive. If I drive it after she's driven it a bit, it's hunting around. It's looking for me to pull my foot down. It's kind of anticipating my actions, and you notice it. So I don't want to drive it very much. I bought her a nice car for herself. That 10-speed transmission is particularly. It shifts elegantly when you just are consistent with it. And I think Roy's thought about that you should definitely have a way to either lock it out or have it be driver-specific is an excellent idea. This one doesn't have that as far as I know. But it's very, very interesting. Roy's comment about if you're driving a computer is dead-on accurate.
Yeah, I mean, as time goes on, we're going to probably stop even using the term computers because processing units are in everything. They're in humidifiers. They're in space heaters. They're certainly in my radios. So it's just going to be kind of like telling people that conductors are in your electronic equipment. Of course they are. They're going to be ubiquitous. They already are ubiquitous, but we're still describing them as separate aspects.
They're in adult toys, for God's sake.
They're pretty much in everything. I would be stuck, with the exception of relatively still simple things, most candles, most bars of soap don't include a central processing unit. But you would probably be problematic to come up with some product that we use regularly that doesn't have some integrated circuit embedded in it.
Can I say something about sulfating on the batteries?
Sure, Jim.
So it's my understanding that the sulfating process happens when there's like a crystallization of some of the compounds that are in the electrolyte, and the effect of it is they both short plates, the lead plates and the lead acid battery together, and they start to physically deform them, because this is a crystalline structure. So they do mechanical and chemical damage. And these desulfating charges can reverse that to an extent. But generally, if your car battery is sulfated and enough to make it not start on a cold day, you probably want to replace the battery. The nice thing is, like I said, you can go to an AutoZone and have them test the battery. If you get a little widget, I think the common way that they there's a widget that goes in the cigarette lighter that takes like a 9-volt transistor radio battery, if they still call it that, and that's enough to maintain the memory in the car. And you test the battery, they're going to say the battery's bad, you put a new battery in, and you're done. But the sulfating thing, you can play with, but really, most people need a more reliable car than trying to patch up a sulfated battery. Back to that.
Okay, very good, Jim. Yeah, I mean, even back in the good old days, Dick, K2RW, I think there were some people who were on the Canadian Ontario repeaters who were very knowledgeable about desulfonating charging devices. I've never quite figured out how legitimate or illegitimate it is. As you mentioned, the idea was to superimpose a square wave to kind of shock the electrodes and give some kind of physical knock to them where it knocks some of the material. What happens is a lead acid battery is basically two electrodes. One is made out of lead, one is made out of lead oxide, and it's sitting in a bath of sulfuric acid. So the diluted sulfuric acid. So what happens is the sulfur plates out on the electrode and acts as an insulator and blocks the charge, discharge, recharge cycle of the electrode. So the more of the electrode surface area is coated with sulfonation, the less efficient the battery operates, and the idea that these magical chargers can kind of knock some of the sulfonation off of the cathode and the anode and give it a second lease on life. You know, sometimes it's worth it. As Jim mentioned, in cars, you probably don't want to screw around. If it looks like it's in a fail mode or very close to a fail mode, it's safer to just get a new battery. Lead acid battery technology hasn't really changed much in about 30, 40 years. You know, it kind of changed when they made them sealed and membrane type of technology. But the chemistry has been the same for the last 200 years.
What does a booster do? How come when I put a booster on it, the car starts right up?
It's another battery. You're providing it another energy source that you've topped off and charged recently. So you have a fully charged, smaller battery capable of enough of current to turn over your engine. And as Craig mentioned, the big thing is turning over the engine and getting the alternator to start working, because as long as the engine is going and you have a functioning alternator that's generating power, the battery isn't that important anymore.
Comment?
Yes, Jim.
So, consider this. Let's say your car needs, I'm going to throw arbitrary numbers out of the conversation. Let's say your car needs 10 amps to start on a regular day. Your battery can put out 10 amps. Your battery can put out 20 amps. But on a regular day, it'll start at 10 amps. On a 20-degree day, it might take 20 amps to start the car, but the battery's only putting out 10. If you add another 10 from the booster, it'll start. Now, what I mentioned earlier about when you connect to the terminals, most batteries have a lead terminal, and most of them have a boost, some of them have a bolt, that most of these are back to the boost, what they used to have. And those corrode. And the nice thing about it is they're relatively easy to clean most of the time. They don't corrode away. You just have to clean up the corrosion and make sure there's a good mechanical connection. But if that connection is bad and you connect the booster on to the top of the terminal, you're bypassing that bad connection from the post to the terminal and going right to the car system. So your booster has a better connection into the electrical system than the battery does. So it basically bypasses the problem, if the problem is a terminal connection problem. So again, if your car takes, it's going to take on a cold day 20 amps to start, and if you give it 5, you give it 15, well, it'll start. I hope that clarifies it. Back to that.
Jim, how long, how do you know how long to charge a battery?
What would you be charging it with?
12-volt charger. I have, it's a pretty big thing. It's a 12-volt charger to charge car batteries.
Does it have an amp meter on it?
It does.
Sure. So typically you'll connect the whole thing together and it'll start charging at a fairly high rate, and as it tops off the battery, that charge rate will reduce. And, you know, if you charge it overnight, usually that's fine. But if the charge rate doesn't reduce, or the charge rate doesn't read at much charge at all, if the amperage going in, it won't take it. That's another thing. But, charge it overnight. But I have to, it sounds to me like your battery is shot. And the real question is, how old is it? If it's 5 years old and it didn't start on a 20-degree day, time to get a new battery.
WA2 VSM.
Yes, VSM?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, Jim. The operator wants to know how long should you charge a battery. Any deep battery charger starts off at a high charge rate and automatically tapers down and can go as low as a trickle charge to maintain the battery. But it shouldn't take an overnight charge to charge a car battery. That's absurd. I have this big battery charger that they have in car repair places, and within an hour or so on a high charge rate, you have more than ample charge in the battery. And of course, as you mentioned before, unless the battery won't take the charge, then you can charge it all day and night to no avail.
Okay, thanks. Let me just make sure I got the repeater. Okay, I think I got the repeater. Most of these chargers that I've seen tend to have little indicators when it's met some criteria. Either that it has gone from full charging to trickle charging, or also what happens with batteries is as you charge them, their voltage potential goes higher and higher. A fully charged lead acid battery has a higher voltage than a lead acid battery that's only half charged. So some devices use voltage potential between the two cathode and anodes of the battery. Others use the charge, whether it's rapid charging or trickle charging, as an indicator. Does your recharger have any kind of little green light that tells you when it's done?
No, it just has a little meter on it. I'm also a little confused with charging at 6 amps versus 12 amps. I guess that's a trickle charge versus a regular charge.
No, I wouldn't call six amps a trickle charging. Some people are very cautious. If you charge a rechargeable battery more slowly, you don't heat it up as much and you don't age the chemistry in the battery. So some people who have a lot of free time would rather slow charge their batteries than rapid charge their batteries. Rapid charging uses much more current, it heats up the battery, it ages, it accelerates the aging of the rechargeable battery, you get less of a life, but you get to use the battery earlier than if you do a slow charge on it. Trickle charging is just a nominal amount of current going through it so that, you know, any kind of internal drainage of current won't manifest itself.
Really making the machine a time.
Say again?
You're barely making the machine at time.
Well, I don't know what to tell you again. For some bizarre reason, the All-Star works well in one direction but not in the other. So I as much as it's important for you to hear my words of wisdom, I need to hear yours as well. And I have it cranked up to the 50 watts that this ICOM 7100 is capable of. So that's all I got to throw at it.
Do you make a comment?
Yeah, sure.
This is K2VCV, Gene in Selden. Yeah, as far as batteries are concerned, I've worked with a lot of batteries and everything else. And I worked with lithium-ion batteries. But getting back to the lead-acid battery, I had some problems on a boat. I have these 1,000 amp-hour batteries on a boat. I have a pair of them. And the only way to test them really is to, I bought one of these Harbor Freight battery testers that cost only about $20, and that thing does wonders. Let me tell you, I saw this on YouTube, and what it does is it puts the load, about 100 amps of load, on the battery, and it can tell you if it's good or bad. Very, very good device. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I've seen all kinds of different battery testers at all different price points. Probably the most important to the consumer is if you give it enough of a load that kind of mimics turning over a battery, turning over a car engine, that should be sufficient. But, you know, if you go out there, there's all kinds of very interesting and somewhat overpriced electronics that will supply a load over a long period of time and generate a discharge curve that you can then compare with the standard curves and such. But if it works for you, then that's great, and you know, so you save the money. Not everyone needs to run lab experiments.
I'm done.
Yeah, someone said something?
Yeah, don't neglect that alternator. Before starting, you should read at the battery about 13.2, and then when you get the engine started, it should read about 14.4. Don't neglect the alternator first.
Okay, words of wisdom.
To ensure that by disconnecting the battery, you're not erasing all the memory, what about putting the booster, connecting the booster to the wires going to the battery while you're taking out the battery? Would that help, or would that damage anything?
That's a good idea.
PhD?
Yes, Jim. I think Ed kind of commented while you were talking that that was a good idea. I would agree. Jim, what do you think?
Seems to me that what I've understood that the people that do that, I've never had to do it, but that you can get on Amazon a little widget. It takes a 9-volt battery with a cigarette lighter plug, you put it in the dashboard, and it back feeds the system to keep enough voltage to keep your memories happy. And then you're not going to knock the alligator clip off in the engine compartment while you're messing around with things. I understand those work okay. I haven't used them myself, but I think that's that might be a solution. Of course, the electrical system has gotten so complicated, maybe that undermines that thought some. There's so many different control widgets going on. It's everything you plug into isn't just to the battery anymore. The old ham radio theory was run on your wires right to the battery. That doesn't even work anymore. So, again, if your battery is 5 years old and it didn't start when it's 20 degrees, replace the battery and clean and service the terminals so that they're impeccable. That's the step you're at. Back to that.
Comment WA2VFM.
Yeah, VFM.
Yeah, I just want to say, first of all, hello again to Jim. And to the other station, 5 years... and you wonder whether you should change your battery? Count your blessings. You've done very well. You got 5 years use out of the battery.
Actually, I don't know how old the battery is.
Oh, not Jim. Not you, Jim. The other person. We have a whole house generator. So we have a battery outside, of course, to start the system. And once it gets between 3 and 4, that's about it. So we have to replace those batteries. and on my cars too. The biggest problem is if you drive a lot less, you know, you may not even keep the battery fully charged. So, but 5 years, no, if someone has a battery 5 years.